It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The book is considered one of humanity's greatest creations, and a lot of people would say that war is one of our worst. But according to our next guest, the two are more interconnected than we think. In his new book, he traces the role that the printed word has played in conflicts around the globe, in propaganda, as a military target, as a pastime on the front line and the home front, and much more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you seek out books about war, either fiction or nonfiction? Have you read any historically significant books that played central roles in the wars of the past? If you've served in the military yourself, did books help relieve the stress and or the tedium? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew Pettigrew is an award-winning author and professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. His newest book is called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very pleased to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
One of the first assumptions you tackle in the book is the idea that books are inherently peaceful. Why do we usually think that? And how have books really been wrapped up so much in violence and conflict?
Well, I think all through the history of book ownership, they've been, for many people, a marker of civilization, as I think are libraries, which is why any attempt to close a public library or to cut its hours is always greeted by howls of protest, even by people who don't truthfully regularly use those libraries. So people think of print culture as a uniquely civilizing influence and don't take into consideration the fact that dictatorships are as aware of the value of books as are democracies.
You focus in a lot on the era before World War I and the books written for grown-ups and for kids, and how much they, in many ways, prepared people, got people excited even for the concept of war. Can you talk a little bit about how so many countries follow that path?
Yes, between about 1870 and the outbreak of the First World War, there weren't a lot of conflicts between frontline great powers. In Europe, at least in Western Europe, it was largely a peaceful period, and most of the conflicts were imperial conflicts between Western armies and local peoples in the areas that they had added to their empires. So in this period of relative peace, people felt pretty good about themselves in places like Germany and Britain. And if they felt less good, it was because they thought they hadn't had their fair share of the imperial cake when the rest of the world had been sliced and diced. So there was a sort of literature of glorification, if you like, of imperialism, often cunningly disguised in boys' magazines, where young heroes went out into the colonies and showed their natural leadership abilities. So it was a period which valued leadership skills, it valued courage, and it valued self-sacrifice. So this is what led so many people to rush into recruitment offices when the First World War broke out, with, as we now know, tragic consequences.
And World War One itself, when we look back and think of the literature and the poetry that came out of that, I think we might think of what came out of the end of it and the regret and the horror of war. You point out it's estimated that there was an explosion, like 50,000 poems a day, or so, I can't remember the exact number of, in most cases, pro-war poetry. There was an explosion of very positive war print at the outset of that war.
Yeah, what we find in both the First and Second World Wars is that whatever people thought before the war about the prospect of going to war, and in 1939, people were incredibly terrified of another war, not least because they feared bombing would be much more effective. Nevertheless, all of the professional groups in society, the lawyers, the judges, the police, the authors, the publishers, students, professors, they all rallied to the patriotic cause of their own nation. And in total war, everyone is vulnerable, but it also means that everybody wants to do their piece to play their part. And this comes in very many different ways. Sometimes it consists of rummaging around in your cupboards to find some books, either to give, to be sent to the troops, or to be pulped, to be recycled into the war effort. And I found in my investigations that actually more books were lost through the salvage operations, where all these books were gathered to be recycled, than actually as victims of the bombing, which is a rather extraordinary fact.
When people think of World War II and books, they might think of the book burnings, of course, in Nazi Germany. Shocked the world in many ways. It served as a symbol of the Nazi regime. You have an image of that. You also have an image from Baraboo, Wisconsin, 1918, where people are burning German language books with a large German immigrant population here in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit about that maybe lesser known wave of book burning here in the U.S.?
Well, my apologies for singling out Baraboo, but yes, when the United States joined the conflict in 1917, there was an enormous amount of pent-up energy to be put into raising the money for the troops, for collecting books for the troops. But this also had its negative impact in the sense that German neighbors or neighbors of German heritage suddenly found themselves very coldly received. And one consequence of that, and this again comes down to trying to do something, was a clear out of German language books in the public libraries and often too in school libraries. Now, that is something which I'm afraid the American public had largely forgotten by the time of the Nazi book burning. So they reacted very, very adversely to when they heard of the Nazi book burnings. Demonstrations were held, but without reflecting too much on their own context.
Andrew Pettigrew is with us. His new book is called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrew, you look at the book as a wide concept, hardcover books, softcover books, and pamphlets and maps. I want to give a listen here to President Franklin Roosevelt speaking in February 1942, 2 months after Pearl Harbor, looking at the Pacific theater of war.
It is warfare in terms of every continent, every island, every sea, every air lane in the world. That is the reason why I have asked you to take out and spread before you a map of the whole earth and to follow me in the references which I shall make to the world-encircling battle lines of this war.
FDR says to take out your maps, and in your introduction, I believe you mentioned that maps, atlases, globes sold out pretty much over the next week after that speech.
Well, thank you for finding that clip. It's wonderful to hear it. Yes, FDR was a tremendously empathetic speaker and judge of his electorate. And he knew that once America was at war, everybody would want to know what was going on. But here was the problem, that in many respects, America found itself woefully underprepared in terms of their knowledge of the Pacific islands and atolls where their boys would be sent to fight. And at one point, they adopted the rather desperate maneuver of asking the public to send in their holiday snaps and guidebooks in the hope that this would improve knowledge of, for instance, the Solomon Isles. And that wasn't much use. What happened was that the librarian of the Library of Congress then organized a scheme whereby this never happened again. So he gathered together the major public and university libraries, and each of them was designated a sphere of collecting, so that all the books, let's say, on India would be collected by one library, and so on and so forth, so that if they found themselves once again in an unexpected naval or land war against anywhere on the globe, they would at least have the resources with which to fight such a war. And it does bring home how important knowledge of every square mile of the world's territory is essential if you're going to be prepared for these sometimes not well-anticipated conflicts.
Andrew Pettigrew is with us. His new book is called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your opinion of wartime censorship? We've heard of a couple of examples so far. Are there books you think were justified in being taken off shelves or destroyed during wartime? Have you served in the military? How important were books for you as recreation, maybe during your deployment? We'll talk about that in just a bit. You could join in with your experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Andrew Pettigrew from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, professor of modern history there, looking at his new book. It's called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict, Conflict Shaped Reading. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you read an influential book about war, fiction or nonfiction? If you've served in the military, maybe overseas during a conflict or peacetime, was reading a part of the way you passed the time? Join in at 800-642-1234. Andrew, something I learned, one of the many things I learned in your book, just a few days after the D-Day invasion during World War II, ships brought in critical supplies, crates and crates of books for the troops to read. This is something you focus on a lot, the role that reading played for troops during wartime. Tell us a little bit of what you found.
Well, the American service editions, which were the books that were coming ashore, one of those most remarkable ventures of the war. It had become clear that the books given to these book drives weren't really the sort of things that the troops wanted to read, and they were sort of hardback books which it was difficult to fit anywhere into your gear. So instead, the Army and the Navy got together and they commissioned what was ultimately a series of 1,000 different titles, mostly of modern fiction, but some classics, some non-fiction titles. And these were published in significant editions in a paperback format, which was made to go into the pocket of their combat trousers. And then these were just given away free of charge to troops wherever they were outside the United States. And getting them to these small detachments on numerous Pacific islands was an extraordinary logistical triumph. And they were enormously popular, something like 122 million copies of these books were published.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Justin is with us in Menominee. Justin, hello.
Yes, I just was wondering if you had any insight on how anti-war kind of poetry such as that by like Siegfried Sassoon, Counterattack and Other Poems and other, remarque on sort of the German side here of World War One, how that impacted European perceptions of war.
Oh, interesting question, Justin, and that is something that you get into in the book, Andrew.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that question. It is indeed extremely interesting. What I would say is the normal pattern is that this sort of literature of reflection and regret tends to follow about a decade after the war is over. And it's then when people are sufficiently detached for it to be able to think through these consequences without seeming unpatriotic. And it's certainly the case with Siegfried Sassoon and Homark and all the other authors of the First World War pity of war school, if you like. They didn't sell particularly well at the time, it must be said, and they sort of came back into favor in the 1960s, when the general climate was much more susceptible to anti-war sentiment. But then, you know, we have to remember that the same is pretty much true of the Vietnam War, when a lot of the best writing about Vietnam came long after the conflict had failed. At the time, the American people were much more supportive of the war than we've come to think of it in retrospect.
Justin, thanks for that call. We're talking to historian Andrew Pettigrew about his new book, The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. Andrew, there's a lot of attention to books that get censored during wartime. Something that surprised me was that in the run-up to World War II, Hitler's book Mein Kampf was a bestseller in England, and for at least some of the Allied troops, it was not banned. The sense, I think, that the more you read this, the more you're going to want to stop Hitler. Could you talk about that decision a little bit?
Well, the first complete translation of Mein Kampf into English only occurred in 1938-1939. Before, there'd been a heavily sanitized version. So FDR, for one, was certainly should be a full version so people could see the full impact of what Hitler was saying. In consequence, far from being banned, Mein Kampf was put on recommended reading lists for camp libraries when army camps were set up all around Britain. With that exception, I would say that the wartime censorship is more similar in the dictatorships and the democracies than one might imagine. But it mostly was imposed on the newspapers rather than the books. A couple of books in Britain were withdrawn, not because they were pro-German, but because it was thought the plot line might cause the Germans to realize that the secret of Enigma had been broken and the Brits were listening to German transmissions. Now, that was rather paranoid, but it does show how important it was seen to be to keep the secret of Enigma as long as possible. And in fact, it was the Germans didn't really know the extent to which the British and Americans were listening to their traffic until after the war.
During wartime, you write that people do a lot of reading, whether at home or on the front. Did people seem to prefer books about war or books about anything but war to escape that reality for a while?
I think it differs a little bit. On the home front, there was interest in every aspect of the war. You know, why France fell in 1940, why the Finns had put up such a good fight against the Russians in 1939. When Russia joined the war, there was a surge of books about Russia published in Britain. So, you know, on a home front, I think there is enormous interest in what's going on, and that caused a considerable reorientation of the publishing industry to take that into account. I think troops were more interested in recreational reading and, I think, in newspapers. That was a very important part in their lives, and special newspapers for the troops became a feature of the Allied forces, with once again the very well-resourced troops of the United States having a particularly strong performance in terms of truce newspapers, not least Stars and Stripes, which was distributed throughout the world.
And just our last couple of minutes, Andrew, books and libraries of books, collections, were often targets in wartime. Why did we see, in some cases, bombing campaigns and other efforts to destroy books on the enemy side?
Well, in one respect, books were bound to be collateral damage. If you've got sort of unrestricted bombing warfare, because libraries have premises often in the city centres, often rather splendid buildings, they're almost certain to be attacked. But on the other hand, libraries were also important war resources. The New York Public Library, for instance, had one of the best map collections in the United States. It was bound to be used for military purposes. When the German Luftwaffe destroyed the center of Coventry, including its public library, they were destroying many people's houses. Many people lost their lives, but it also destroyed one of the great collections of technical industrial literature in the Coventry Public Library. It's not as if libraries weren't playing a role in the war.
Andrew, just in our last few minutes, do you think these issues are still relevant now in the internet age and how we think of books in conflict?
Well, you'd think that books would be less relevant, but if you study the Ukrainian war of the present day, you see so many phenomena that we associate with the Second World War, libraries being destroyed by bombing, a flight to the West, leaving all your collections of books behind, libraries being used to teach Russian-speaking Ukrainian citizens Ukrainian when they go out, the paper being scarce and more costly, white writers being weaponized on both sides, and Ukrainians taking into central collecting points their Russian language books so that they can be pulped for reuse. Or every aspect of that is 20th century, even if the war is being fought with 21st century weapons.
Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, it's been a real pleasure.
Andrew Pettigrew is an award-winning author and professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.